You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 274.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. My next interview I recorded back in New Hampshire. That is a good old New Hampshire interview. I like being reminded of New Hampshire, and I had such a great time listening to it. Sometimes you learn more from the re-listen than you do as the actual interviewer. I'm always surprised by how many of you out there like our coverage of scientific topics, of mathematical topics. I get usually the most feedback from those, aside from some of the more political ones. And today's episode really is the real deal. TM, the real deal trademark. You're gonna get real stuff today. My update is that now I have my workplace set in Stanford, so I look forward to doing some video interviews again soon. And I spoke to Aaron last night, excited to have him back on the show in maybe next week or the week after. I know it was the Boston Marathon today, so there must have been a lot of activity in his area. Anyway, let's learn about quantum physics and quantum computing. My next guest is the perfect person to do just that. He has a PhD in physics and actually works in quantum computing. Ian McCormick, you've reached the Local Maximum. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Max. It is good to be here. Usually I seek out local minima, but it's a nice change of pace.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really was annoyed with in machine learning, because they're always, you know, you can easily set up the problems to find a local maximum, because I always think of, you know, like, we're maximizing probability or maximizing rewards, but then they always flip the problem around on you, and it's like, well, we're minimizing loss. It's almost like a double negative. I don't know if that bothers me.
It could just be caveman physics intuition of wanting the ball to roll to the bottom of the hill or something.
Maybe, but isn't that... That's not a high energy state or low energy state. I guess so.
Can always change the sign if it suits you.
Says a physicist. Okay, I get it. Okay. All right, so we're here to talk about quantum computing today. And also, you know, I want to hear a little bit about your background, first of all, because this is the first time we've talked about quantum computing on the program with any depth. So how does one fall into quantum computing? You know, it's not exactly something every company is doing right now, but a lot of people have been talking about it. People have been asking me about quantum computing for many years. So you studied physics, is that correct?
Yeah, I did my undergrad and PhD in physics. I didn't specifically study quantum computing, and I should say that I studied theoretical condensed matter physics. So I'm a theory guy, a lot of pencil and paper and calculations and computer simulations. I wasn't working in a lab on hardware. Although I did a PhD, I never really had any intention of going into academia, and sort of partway, I'd say towards the end of my PhD, I had been aware of quantum computing as a concept. I'd learned a couple of the basic algorithms, along the way, but I noticed that it had started to become actually a trend in industry, and there were companies building quantum computers and trying to actually use them for practical purposes. And so I thought, okay, well, given that I don't really want to go down the academic path, this seems like a pretty good possible option after graduate school.
And yeah. Well, can I ask, what area of physics were you studying before that?
Yeah. I studied theoretical condensed matter physics, which can mean a lot of things. I was kind of there's a kind of community of physicists that's sort of loosely called It from Qubit, which is kind of at the intersection of quantum condensed matter physics, that is studying the physics of many body quantum mechanical systems, quantum information theory, which studies things like entanglement entropy and things like that in physical systems, and formal high energy physics, where sort of the string theorists come from. So the things I did my PhD were pretty varied, ranged from working a bit on ADS-CFT, which is kind of more in the high energy physics realm, to numerical simulations of lattice-like condensed matter physics systems.
Yeah, some of this is getting kind of beyond my knowledge of even where the fields are. But let's start with quantum mechanics a little bit. You know, sure. I took one class at Yale on physics, which was the hardest. I didn't mean to take the hardest physics class for there are different levels, but
I
it was the only one that fit into my schedule, and it was like you had to take you already had to be really tight with linear algebra and multidimensional manifolds, which I was like kind of wrapping my head around.
Was it like the advanced like first year physics course or something?
Yeah. And it was like
that was also the hardest physics course for me.
yeah. It was like one day they came in and he derived the theory of relativity from scratch, basically. Yeah. If I remember correctly, this is all 20 years ago. So,
yeah.
But quantum mechanics was a part of it, and I remember thinking, okay, like now we're talking about probability clouds or something, and maybe this is one of the earliest. Experience, come to think of it, for me, when I was thinking about information as probability clouds. Mm-hmm. Of course, quantum mechanics is a really unique way of representing that. And come to think of it, I actually did ask a previous guest on the show, I'm going to write this down, a mathematician, Danae Bradley, about, I think it was her, when I think at some point the conversation weaved into like, hey, like, is there any way to represent probability as like these imaginary numbers, like we and have it be something useful that we can like use to like model something it does model something in the real world, obviously quantum mechanics, but I'm talking like if I'm trying to model like marketing data or something.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, but anyway, I'm rambling a little bit on that, but maybe we can start, because this is tough stuff for a lot of people. Maybe we can start by explaining how quantum mechanics is different from regular old mechanics and where computing fits in.
Sure.
And let's try to keep it, let's try to keep most people, and then we can push it afterwards.
Sure. I'll start with a mildly technical sort of explanation.
Okay.
But then I will, I'll give a broader stroke, because I think so the mildly technical one is just for those that have at least a vague memory of linear algebra.
Okay.
If you know linear algebra, then quantum mechanics is not so scary. A quantum mechanical system, mathematically, consists of a state, often called a wave function, that's represented in a vector space. And importantly, that state is normalized. So it maintains a unit length. The state has a particular structure. It's a Hilbert space, which means it has a particular inner product.
So normalized meaning, like the space in some sense adds up to one, or
so
integrates
so that
to
the
one?
Length of this vector is always one.
Okay, it's
or the length squared rather, which is to and the reason and the reason that is.
It's like, one squared is one, right? So it has to be.
It's so that it has to, so that it maintains its interpretation, so that the wave function squared or magnitude squared maintains the interpretation of a probability distribution.
Right.
Okay. So this vector, and if, you can imagine a vector in, say, in XYZ Cartesian coordinates.
Okay.
These are
just
our basis vectors. Say we have some vector in this space. It's a linear combination of the x, y, and z basis vectors. And if we normalize it, as in quantum mechanics, each component of that vector represents essentially the probability, the extent to which that quantum mechanical state occupies each one of those basis states. So let me rewind
a little bit.
Yeah, I'll rewind a little bit there. I've mentioned we have these states. I might have gotten a little technical there. An important feature of quantum mechanics, and maybe the basic feature that makes it So unintuitive to sort of human scale reasoning is that fundamentally things are probabilistic, and that when a quantum mechanical system is not being observed, when it's just evolving freely, it can be in a superposition of multiple different states. So that could be probably a familiar example from, you know, high school chemistry. Say in an atom, the electrons in the cloud can be in a superposition, that is to say, like a probability distribution over several of the different electron orbitals. And that probability distribution, or rather, that probability distribution corresponds to the square magnitude of the quantum mechanical wave function, which is the ultimate, the state that defines the system.
So it the way I think about it, like, tell me if I'm off base, is like, in our space, in the universe, like, almost, you could almost say, like, location doesn't exist, or at least, like, points in space don't exist. But of course, that that sort of screws with our notions of, like, Newtonian physics, or you know. So it's but yeah, I guess the whole, like, marbles on a board thing doesn't work when you actually look at the marbles.
So when you get to the scale of marbles, this no longer exactly applies. I can sort of explain why later, but that would be sort of a digression. But
yeah,
the point is, whether it's, you know, if you say have the simplest molecule, say hydrogen, where you have one electron, it can be in a superposition of these orbitals until you observe the electron. And depending on what you measure, suppose I measure the energy of this electron, it will then subsequently collapse. And don't ask me how, because that's a longer digression. The state will collapse into one of the definite energy state orbitals. So previously it occupied a superposition of these orbitals with different energies until I try to measure or observe the energy, at which point it collapses into a definite state of the orbitals.
Right. So what does that have to do with computing? And I find it really interesting that we could even compute with these kinds of systems. Like, how does that even work?
Can I add a little bit of a technical aside that will just be useful for those with, it's not strictly necessary, but it'll be useful to keep in the back of your mind for later.
Okay.
So the other important thing is that, so a quantum mechanical system, and we'll go to an even simpler system, and this is what we'll use for most of the explanations. The simplest quantum mechanical systems are spins, like specifically spin 1/2 objects, which you can think of as, well, physically you can think of as little magnets, but fundamentally it's a system that can occupy two states, up or down. The wave function of a spin could be some combination of these two, so that when I measure it, I have, say, 60% probability of landing on an up state, 40% probability of landing on a down state, etc. And of course, again, this wave function is complex, complex valued, so we take the square magnitude of it to get a probability distribution.
Right. Complex not as in complicated, but as in
complex numbers, yeah. So the digression I wanted to mention is that I said that, you know, at the quantum mechanical scale, things are fundamentally probabilistic. And that is true when you're doing measurements, you can't predict perfectly, what the outcome of a measurement will be. However, the evolution of a closed quantum mechanical system is deterministic. You've probably heard of Schrodinger's equation.
It's deterministic before you've observed, is what you're saying.
Correct,
so,
yeah.
Okay.
So the wave function evolves according to Schrodinger's equation.
Okay.
Which is to say, so the system, essentially its energy and the interactions between the different degrees of freedom are encoded in what's called a Hamiltonian. And if you essentially solve Schrodinger's equation, which is a bit like, It looks a bit like the heat equation. It's a sort of wave equation, but with complex numbers in it. You find that the if you have some initial state and you evolve it forward in time with a solution to Schrodinger's equation, that the state maintains its normalization. Put it in slightly more technical terms, the time evolution operators for closed quantum systems are unitary operators. So for discrete systems, that would be unitary matrices. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're losing us in some of us over here, but I think the bottom line that I got out of it, so I'm just going to try to summarize,
sure,
is that we have these wave functions instead of like points or something, mm-hmm, we have these wave functions to represent particles, objects. Mm-hmm. They could be superpositions of two things, up and down. They could be something more complicated than that. And if you have some particles, like a bunch of wave functions that overlap, and you don't mess with it, you let it go, it's deterministic. Like if the wave function is this at time zero, then a minute later it'll definitely look like that. That's deterministic.
Correct.
In terms of where the probability juice goes.
Yep.
So it's like only when you observe somewhere in between that, then does it have this like kind of spooky, wave function collapse. Which,
correct,
it's my understanding that like physicists are not like in agreement on how to interpret that just yet. Am I wrong about that? Or am I right about that? I should probably pause.
I don't think that's a huge area of contention. As far as doing calculations, you don't really need to think about that.
Right, right. In terms of like debating about whether there are alternate universes or whatever.
Sure, you don't even need to go into the philosophical realm to get interesting answers about what happens during wave function collapse.
Okay.
But I'll leave that there.
Good idea.
Getting back to, how the hell does all this relate to information and computing? So we'll go back to spins, our simple two-state systems. And so we're treating these as an abstraction. You know, this is just an abstract two-state system, the same way we think of bits as just abstract two-state systems. I can talk later about how you can encode them in a physical system. But okay, so these spins can occupy two possible states, up or down, or zero and one if you prefer. And to describe an arbitrary state of a spin, you need, roughly speaking, two numbers, basically. The probability that it's pointing up and the probability that it's pointing down. Really,
okay,
it's one real number and one imaginary number.
We don't have to get into the math of it.
So, but roughly speaking, to describe the state of a single spin, you need two real numbers, okay? Two floating point numbers.
No, I have a question. Mm-hmm. Maybe I don't want to get you off track here. Is this something that, like, as the computer operator, is this something that we know beforehand? Like, okay, we can set it up so that this this particle is 60-40, and then we're going to see how the system evolves?
Sure, yeah. For a single spin, yeah, I could write that down on that piece of paper.
Okay.
Yeah,
And can you actually create it in the physical?
In the physical world? Yes, and we can get into that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's one spin. That's fine. It's a two-dimensional vector space.
Okay.
Two-dimensional complex value
vector
space.
And then I'm allowed
space
to observe it. And then sometimes...
Yeah, you're allowed to observe it, and it'll collapse to one of those two states. So
that could be a really expensive random number generator.
In fact, that is one of the earliest sort of possible applications. and that is what some quantum computers currently are. Hmm. Not to throw shade, but... In quantum information theoretic terms, what I just described, we'll call a qubit. So as opposed to a traditional computing bit, that is in a deterministic state of zero or one, where information is stored in essentially strings of bits. Qubits can be in superpositions of zero and one. And what happens when I add a second qubit? The dimension of the possible state space goes from 2 to 4. I multiply the dimensions of the two state spaces of the two qubits.
So, okay, right. That makes sense. I mean, same with regular bits, right? Then you have four different combinations.
Yeah. And so if I have n bits, I have a 2 to the n dimensional, roughly speaking, space. And
it's a box that you're in the interior of a box instead of, like in a hypercube, right?
Well, you're really on a hypersphere because it's a normalized vector.
But oh, yeah. Okay.
So this is also true for bits, as you correctly. So if I have n bits, there are 2 to the n possible configurations of the bits. But in classical computing, the bits are only ever in a particular deterministic state. Right.
Right.
With a qubit, if I have n qubits, I need, roughly speaking, 2 to the n floating point numbers to describe the wave function that they're currently occupying, to describe the full quantum mechanical dynamics of it. And in order to...
Oh, wait, you need 2 to the n numbers, not just n numbers. Like,
correct.
Because I was thinking, hey, each one has a probability associated with it between 0 and 1. Okay, fine, we do something... we make it a complex number, fine, but that's not much more complicated. But what I'm hearing is, no, like every subset of them needs some kind of a number.
So, yeah, to add a little technical jargon, if the space in which multiple qubits live is the tensor product space of the individual qubits. And basically just what that means is each qubit is a two-dimensional system. Every time I add another one, I multiply the size of the dimension of the state space by 2.
Wait. So, okay. Here's the way I'm thinking about it. Mm-hmm. When you add a bit in traditional computing, you are adding a dimension because... You're kind of adding a dimension to the box, or let's say you add a new floating point number.
Well, you're still multiplying the dimension when you add a traditional bit, but you don't have to keep track of superpositions of over all possible bits.
So it sounds like it's increasing the number of possibilities, increasing by like an order of magnitude or like exponentially as compared to traditional computing. Because you are adding in traditional computing, because like if I have 10 numbers, that's 10 dimensions. I add an 11th number, that's an 11th dimension. But it sounds like in quantum, no, it's like 2 to the 11, and so things are going crazy.
Yeah, so you're
I'm oversimplifying, and we don't have time to explain to me the whole thing, but that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, no, so if you think you can think about it in terms of, so before, you know, a single qubit is a zero or one, say we have two qubits. Okay. So it can occupy four possible states now, 0, 0,
right.
1, 1,
sure.
1, 0, 0, 1.
Sure.
And then, so we need four numbers to describe that.
Yep.
We put another qubit in the system. Now we have an eight dimensional space.
Okay.
And you can list out all of the, you know, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, et cetera. Now think about a binary string of length n, and now think about and each one of those we associate with a dimension in a vector space. So there are 2 to the n dimensions, and our vector, the state of our qubit, lives somewhere in this space as a continuous linear combination of all of these binary bit strings of n bits.
So then it's put it another way, they're not independent probabilities.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we can talk about entanglement, but this is ultimately the what entanglement boils down to as well. I can demystify that as well. So, okay. Well, so the point is, if you want to simulate a system of n qubits, you need 2 to the n, you need to store and manipulate 2 to the n floating point numbers. So that gets, that very quickly chews up your memory and like computing power. So,
like, okay, 64 bits, I can store 64 bits easily, but 64 qubits, that's, I don't know if we're getting to the realm where that's impossible to...
So the world record for exactly simulating without approximations,
right.
a system of qubits, I think is something like 40 qubits.
Right.
And maybe that has changed. Okay. But that you know, required a huge computing cluster. On this laptop here, if I wanted to exactly solve Schrodinger's equation... for some system of interacting qubits, I could do it pretty quickly with like 12 qubits. When I get to 14 or 16, it's going to get really slow.
Wow.
And so at that point, and that's still, you know, 14 or 16 qubits is nothing, right? You know, a couple grams of metal has 10 to the 24 atoms in it, each of which contain, you know, many things, many things that are larger than qubits in their dimension. Go ahead.
So, well, no, I was gonna say this is all really interesting if you have anything to add on that, but like I wanted to step back from, so that's like, okay, that's how the quantum computer works on the most basic level.
Mm-hmm.
But computers, okay, traditional computers, I don't know what you call them, like classical computers work on bits, but then let's build up to like, okay, we're kind of familiar with what classical computers can do.
Sure.
What does this mean? What can quantum computers do? I have to bring up the lecture that I went to on it one time in 2002, so that's now 21 years ago.
So yeah, I think I do need to give a bit more. So
yes,
the reason it's potentially promising is because you have this naturally occurring immense information storage and manipulation capability in just in inherent to quantum mechanics. Because again, like you can't simulate 100 or let alone 1,000 qubits exactly. It's impossible, but 100 or 1,000 physical representations of qubits, maybe you could store and manipulate. And if you can manipulate them in a controlled way, which just is to say to perform gates on them, the way we do with classical computing gates, you know, NAND and XOR operators and whatnot, the quantum mechanical equivalents of those, then maybe we can make algorithms.
Right.
And we can manipulate the states of these qubits in a controlled way, such that when we ultimately take a measurement at the end, because again, at the end of the day, if you want to know anything about your quantum mechanical system, you have to measure something.
Right. So it contains lots of information when it's being simulated, but it's not like you can actually use it to store all that information.
When it's just existing, but when you want to take a look at it, you have to, depending on how much information you want to extract, you have to measure something at the end of the day.
Right.
And you can't at any point get the full state of the qubits for any sufficiently large system.
So it's not, so the first thing that was in my mind wouldn't work, where I'm like, okay, let's say I want to condense like all of YouTube, all the videos on YouTube, and then like just place them in some qubit configuration. You can't get all the videos back because you have to collapse the wave function. But maybe there are applications where you can store lots of stuff.
So yeah, I mean, in principle, you could store all of the videos on YouTube in a large number of qubits. Getting them back would be pretty difficult. That would not be an ideal setting for that. So quantum algorithms, you know, what they boil down to is you have a number of qubits. You apply a series of gates, which take the form of unitary matrices or operators that manipulate single qubits or act on multiple qubits at a time to entangle them or swap them or disentangle them so as to produce a wave function on these qubits, a state that when measured in a particular way, perhaps through many repetitions, will give the answer to some some question or some calculation.
Yeah. So you're sampling from probability distribution all on the hardware, and mm-hmm. I think, and then you could do it many times. So you could build a pretty decent sampler, I guess.
Yeah. So I'll give an example of one of the sort of the first algorithms a person learns maybe when they're reading a quantum mechanics textbook. And if you want a recommendation, if anyone is curious, the sort of the Bible is Nielsen and Chuang. Forget the exact title. It's called Quantum Information or something. But that's a good place to get started if you're curious. So Grover's algorithm is a search algorithm where you you take advantage of the fact that you can have a superposition of potentially all of the bit states at any given time, and you repeatedly apply a particular operator that amplifies the probability of finding the thing that you're searching for. That was a very, very broad overview of Grover's algorithm, mostly because I forget the details of it.
No, okay, but I think I got a concept here. You have some probability distribution you're pulling from. You're sort of applying something to it where mm-hmm. you're constantly increasing the probability of the thing you want. Then I guess at some point you try to get it, and maybe you got it, maybe not. But if you do it a bunch of times, it kind of works.
Right. So, okay. So yeah, what can this be used for? These seem, normal the classical computing algorithms. You know, took geniuses in many cases to come up with. So, like right. These seem like a lot harder to invent. Because you're not just like it's not just like a Turing machine where you have a nice definite state and you're doing definite operations and you get a definite answer.
At least I could wrap my head around how the machine works.
Yeah.
They literally tell you about a Turing machine as like something on a ticker tape.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like very intuitive.
Yeah. Here we have to do something where we're sort of manipulating a probability distribution to sort of push it in the direction such that when we measure it, we get something that's more often in the outcome that we want.
Yeah. We don't have to get into like all the algorithms here because that's going to be too much for our audio audience. But like, you know, when I was in a lecture, they were like, we've done all this research mm-hmm. and we finally figured out how to factorize 15 into 3 and 5. I'm sure you're familiar with that example. Mm-hmm. So have they done better in the last 20 years?
So that's an example of Shor's algorithm. So, okay, yeah, before I talk about algorithms, and again, I won't go into like, gritty details of the algorithms,
yeah.
But basically at this point in time, it's important to divide quantum computing algorithms into two basic categories. One are NISQ algorithms, NISQ, so noisy intermediate scale intermediate-scale quantum computers. So basically, those are the quantum computers we have now. They are noisy. That is, the qubits do not maintain perfect fidelity. And ultimately, this is the biggest challenge in building a quantum computer that is practical, is reducing the amount of noise. But with the existing quantum computers, which range from, a handful to dozens to, well, in some cases, hundreds of qubits, but whether those are all that useful is a question. People have nonetheless, including myself, have spent time thinking about, okay, how might we make use of these noisy qubits that are imperfect, but are still pretty good. They still have some fidelity.
So maybe Can you think of some like applications that we can wrap our head around?
Yes.
That are kind of like coming. Maybe I could divide them into two. What's coming near term and what's coming long term?
So a good example of a type of NISQ algorithm. So there are a lot of basically variational NISQ algorithms. Some of them are sort of machine learning oriented. There are quantum neural networks. Another maybe easier one to wrap your head around is called the variational quantum eigensolver. So basically I have say the Hamiltonian for some quantum system, which is like the energy function for it. And I want to find its ground state, its lowest energy state, and its the lowest energy value. Okay, so much like in machine learning where you have a loss function, and you have some parameters that you minimize to adjust to say minimize your loss function. Here, our loss function is so we create a circuit that contains variable parameters in it on some qubits, and then at the end of it, we measure the energy, the expectation value of the energy over this probability distribution. And and this is what's called a hybrid algorithm, because we measure this energy at a particular parameter value, and then we use a classical computer to compute the gradient of these parameters, and we do gradient descent or something like that to minimize the energy to get an approximate representation of the ground state of this Hamiltonian. It's called variational quantum eigensolver.
So this is, so people are just getting used to AI. Now they're going to have to think about quantum AI. I think it's just going to make training some of these systems much more efficient, or can you do something much more broader than what you're doing now?
So the next bit will be sort of editorial. No, I don't think VQE or most of these sort of we call the hybrid variational algorithms. Hybrid because you still need the classical computer to like compute gradients, and there's this feedback loop between the quantum and classical. If you'd asked me a year ago, I would have been more optimistic about the potential for, say, industrial applications. I'm less optimistic about that now. And so before I go into that, I should say that the other broad class of algorithms are what are called fault-tolerant algorithms, which are algorithms that require quantum error correction, which includes Shor's algorithm, which you alluded to earlier, which factorizes numbers into primes. So, right. So, yeah, as I mentioned, the biggest challenge to building quantum computers is just the presence of noise. We're dealing with very small, delicate physical systems. There are a bunch of different physical systems that can be used as quantum computers. And they're very sensitive to environmental noise, to thermal fluctuations, to, I don't know, errant photons, to weird sort of nonlinear behavior, couplings between distant qubits you didn't anticipate, all of the above and more. And so suppressing noise in these systems is very difficult. And so there's always going to be some noise associated with these systems. And in order to get qubits that maintain perfect fidelity, you don't need a perfectly noiseless physical qubit. So without digressing too much, a common example, a common qubit architecture is what's called a trapped ion. It's kind of exactly what it sounds like. It's an atom, a charged atom, an ion, where the qubit is the two lowest energy states of the atom. And you basically shoot a laser at it to move between those two states, roughly speaking. Okay, so that's we'll call that a physical qubit. It's always going to have some noise level. Just for an example, like single qubit gates. So an operation on a single one of these qubits. These you know, in ideal settings can have, say, 99.99% fidelity. A 2-qubit gate in trapped ions might have 99.8% fidelity in a very idealized experiment. When you're running a lot of them together and you have to run hundreds or thousands of gates, the errors accumulate very quickly and you lose fidelity. But
that problem.
Yeah, and this is why.
So you really need like 99.999.
You know. Yeah. So, but we don't need, we don't actually need perfect fidelity. And in fact, the classical computers we use don't have perfect fidelity.
Sure.
Occasionally there are errant bit flips, but because of their physical size, the physical size of transistors, they're less susceptible to this noise than qubits are. So
and we have error correcting codes.
Yeah, and we have error correcting codes, and analogously, they're quantum error correcting codes, which work a bit differently than classical error correcting codes. So, you know, the simplest sort of classical error correcting code is just a repetition code where I just copy. If I want to send you a one, I just send you, you know, 10 copies of it. And if a couple of them get corrupted, you just take the majority vote.
Right.
And you're likely to have received the correct message. Unfortunately, in quantum mechanics, you can't make copies of states the way you can.
Yeah.
There's no free lunch. You can't make copies of qubits while they're in their superposition.
Right. You could collapse it to a bit and make a copy of that.
Right. But then we're back to classical computing.
Yeah.
Right. But there are algorithms that, like in classical error correcting codes, use multiple physical qubits to encode a single logical qubit. And you can execute a series of operations on this collection of bits to diagnose and correct errors that occur.
Interesting.
Yeah. So go ahead.
If we solve this problem, are we going to be able to factorize large numbers in this like break encryption?
So there are lots of quantum error correction algorithms that exist. I'm not going to explain them here. It would be way too technical. But you know, roughly, it like I said, you take a bunch of physical qubits and you get one, one or some small number of logical qubits, the actual logical units that you're going to operate on out of them. And the estimate that of what you need to, so again, the algorithms are out there. There are lots of them. Lots of people have been working on this since the 90s, I think. Mm. But if you want to have a perfectly error-corrected qubit, which you will need in order to, say, break RSA encryption or to do anything with these fault-tolerant algorithms, if you want to have a perfectly error-corrected qubit, you're going to, you'll still need quite good fidelity. So, you'll want your 2-qubit fidelities the error rate to be less than, say, 1/1000th of a percent per operation. Mm. And you'll probably need thousands of physical qubits per single logical qubit.
Okay.
So that means if I want to, off the top of my head, I don't know, but I think if you want to break RSA encryption or RSA 2048, I'm sure there's upgraded versions of it. I think people estimate you need several thousand logical qubits, error corrected qubits, each of which consists of possibly thousands of physical qubits. So millions of physical qubits with very low fidelity. So
I take it that's hard.
Yeah, it's hard.
Is there some kind of equivalent to Moore's law for quantum computing that could kind of tell us that this might be possible at some point in the future?
Yeah, there is actually. So it's a little different than Moore's law. So, you know, Moore's law measures essentially, if I'm correct, it's like the density of transistors.
I hope you're not going to tell me that it's a complex variable
version
of Moore's law.
I mean, okay. This is semi-equivalent, but if I'm not mistaken, Moore's law is like like an exponential growth in basically like the density of transistors in classical computers, right? So the analogous thing in quantum computing that's kind of just emerged as a benchmark is something called quantum volume, which is like, you know, we're not concerned about density because we're already dealing with microscopic things. But quantum volume sort of takes into account, it's a measure that I think IBM invented, but a lot of people have adopted it to kind of like benchmark and show off their systems. It's a measure that takes into account both the size of the system, the number of qubits, and the fidelity of the system, the error rate, the low error rate. So the bigger of a system you have and the lower of an error rate you have, after executing, let me back that up a little bit. It's a measure basically of the width of the system, which is to say the number of qubits you have, the depth of the circuit you can run, the number of operations you can do in this qubit, and then corrected by the noise level that it experiences. So yeah, the less noise,
kind of combining all of that together.
The more qubits, the less noise, and the more operations you can do, the higher the quantum volume you can achieve. So yeah, okay. that
quantum
is
quantum volume.
Yeah. So you can look it up. I don't know the formula of it off the top of my head. If I say a number of the current record, it's not going to mean anything. But
it's increasing.
Yeah, and exponentially, like Moore's law. Yeah. So that's, I suppose, promising. And I would also say that, like, industry trends, so certainly for a while, even though I only started really paying attention to the quantum computing industry in, like, late 2019, back then people were, like, all in on NISQ, you know, near-term algorithms for doing, you know, chemistry and doing pharmaceuticals and, you know, solving all these complex problems in finance and stuff. I think the enthusiasm for that has waned a bit. Like, I've seen so many like quantum algorithm or quantum software startups come and go. And I think industry is more focused now on just the long-term goal of improving hardware fidelity and just aiming for ultimately error-corrected systems.
So, I mean, my sense is sometimes you have people on the internet saying, hey, quantum computers are going to break encryption like any day now. And it almost seems like,
no. So
it sounds like it's something that could come down the road, but it's we're not close. And I'd almost like to see, I'm sure someone's calculated it out with this quantum volume Moore's law. Someone's calculated it out like when they'd be able to crack this. I almost want to look that up.
Yeah, that's probably not the measure you'd want.
Right.
You can definitely look up the number of logical qubits you'd need. So Shor's algorithm is the algorithm you'd use to crack RSA encryption. But of course, there are other encryption algorithms out there that don't rely on factorizing numbers.
Right.
And there's a sub-research field of post-quantum encryption, which I imagine will probably move faster than the progress in hardware. I wouldn't worry about quantum computers cracking encryption anytime soon.
But it sounds like there are applications in, like, you know, search and optimization and machine learning and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
And I think even with not perfectly error-corrected quantum computers, but slightly less noisy, slightly larger quantum computers than we have now, there still could be worthwhile applications for things like simulating molecules for drug discovery or materials development.
A lot of these are approximations anyway. So,
and they're inherently quantum calculations, so they're well suited.
Right.
Things that are a little more distantly connected would be like optimization algorithms that may potentially, I think at this moment, don't have much promise, but if the noisy quantum computers get a little larger and a little less noisy, potentially could be useful before full error correction.
Yeah.
But that's just speculation.
All right. Yeah. So I mean, we've been talking for a while, so I don't want to keep you. But there's one more question that I had before we wrap up, which is like, when you program a quantum computer, do you have to use a special language or a special framework, or are you just like sitting there using like Python or Java?
I mean, so like just typically, like, yeah, if you program a quantum computer, I mean, usually, so you could go and home and do this tonight. You could go to search Qiskit, Qiskit, or Penny Lane. Qiskit is IBM's quantum simulator and interface to their quantum computers. Yeah, it's basically a Python. Yeah, it is a Python package, and you essentially program at quantum assembly level. In fact, the language.
You're simulating a quantum computer on your own classical computer.
Yeah, and then you can also gain access, even just as a regular civilian, to some of their smaller computers and run small things there.
Really?
Yeah. But
how does one do that? Like, you go on their website?
And mm-hmm. Yeah. Go to IBM, search IBM Quantum. Yeah, wow. You can buy credits from them, or IonQ, or
I mean, I don't know why places. I would do that, but it's almost like if any listener out there
yeah.
finds the need, I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, and they have very small ones available. I think you can use for free to a limited extent. But yeah, so yeah, you're just programming in Python, but you're using that to encode basically assembly level operations. So you're literally encoding a sequence of gates, like C naught is the quantum equivalent of a not gate, and then rotation operators on single qubits. There aren't really yet high level quantum computing programming languages.
Right, so you're not doing like higher order functions or anything.
No,
like that.
No. And in fact, the language, I think the most common language for writing quantum algorithms is called QASM, which is quantum assembly language. And Qiskit Python package is just kind of a wrapper for QASM, more or less.
Right. So you're technically using Python, but it's almost like you're encoding in Python very low level assembly instructions.
Yeah, gate level instructions. And some people, you know, if you want to get the most performance you can go deeper than that and can do things like directly shape the pulses of light that you're shooting at qubits. But that's a level even lower than wow. assembly language. But yeah, there are no like subroutines or higher level like abstractions above assembly language that have really gained any traction. I'm sure people have tried to make them, but they're not like too useful yet.
Yeah, it almost all this stuff makes me think, and it might be a long time or maybe never when like the average developer is actually using this stuff. But do you think there'll come a time when like, you know, the, many companies will be wanting access to quantum computing or maybe using it without knowing it or...
Many companies, not. Possibly.
Certainly like governments and research.
Yeah, no, I can see them being very useful in like specific high value cases and definitely in academic settings too. So that's another early area where some noise is tolerating is simply just simulating quantum systems for basic science.
Yeah.
So like people already do that with quantum computers. I do find it hard to imagine having like a, you know, buying like a QPU the way you buy a GPU and just installing it in your desktop.
Yeah.
I mean,
if I were writing a science fiction movie,
yeah,
maybe I would have my character go to Best Buy and pick one of those up.
It's not impossible to imagine that, you know, that being used for some specialized like optimization subroutines. You know, the way GPUs are used for very specialized subroutines.
Yeah.
But certainly in the like next couple decades, I imagine. Any practical use that could possibly come out of quantum computing will be sort of at the large industry or government level or academic level.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. This whole discussion has been great. It's given us a lot to think about, and I feel like it's been like a kind of drinking from the fire hose experience. So I'm going to try to like end it here and maybe we could all try to sleep on it and wrap our heads around it. I'd love to get some feedback from my listeners on what they think of quantum computing after this discussion. So Ian, thank you so much for coming on the show. Do you have any last thoughts and anything you want to promote? Where can people find out more about you on social media or whatever, or more about what we've spoken about today? Although I have some very good links on
here. Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you, Max, for having me. It was definitely fun to talk about this. I hope I didn't use too much jargon.
It's unavoidable for this topic.
I would recommend if you want to learn about this, just go on IBM's quantum website. They have like a series of tutorials for different levels of technical background that can be fun to play around with if you're interested in this. As far as social media, I am not particularly active on social media. At least not under my real name. The stuff I'm working on right now, I'd have to be a bit secretive about, but if things go well, you'll hear about it in the future. It's tangentially related to quantum computing, but not exactly that.
Okay. So if anyone has a question for you, they can go through me.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds good. All right, Ian, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah. Thank you, Max.
All right. I feel like not only did I get the theoretical rundown today, but for the first time, it feels more real as I have links to like actual software and hardware where I could get started. So like, before it was just kind of on a whiteboard or on a blackboard, whiteboard, what's the difference? But now I feel like I actually can write. Maybe it would take some learning, but I feel like I could actually figure out how to go in and deploy some of this stuff if I wanted to. So that feels more real. And all these links are going to be on the show notes page at localmaxradio.com/276. And those links to the actual software and hardware to get started. Okay. I just want to remind you all to join our locals to talk more about quantum computing, maximum.locals.com. Hope to hear from you there soon. I hope to get an interview in with Aaron this week. We'll see if we can do that. And we have episodes coming up on open source software as well. And 276, I believe it'll be 276, is going to be a very special episode that might throw you for a loop. So look forward to that. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.